This episode is brought to you by Dietz and Watson.
Molly, it's time we have the talk about hot dogs.
Okay. Well, hey, I'm looking for a hot dog that's the real deal, Matthew.
Like a classic hot dog that, like, when you think of, like, the platonic ideal of a hot dog, I recommend Dietz and Watson's Dietz dogs.
Ah, well, I've heard that they're handcrafted and made using only Dietz and Watson premium meat.
I can vouch for this because Dietz and Watson sent us a big box of hot dogs and other delights, and wife of the show, Lori, and I had them for dinner last night. We had the classic beef Dietz dogs with toasted buns with sauerkraut and pickled jalapenos and Dietz and Watson ballpark-style yellow mustard.
Do you think you'd recommend Dietz and Watson hot dogs for fried rice?
Oh, yeah. Fried rice with some sliced hot dogs. I'm going to be doing that soon. Wife of the show, Lori, is going to be making the hot dog flour buns from Christina Cho's cookbook, Mooncakes and Milk Bread. Very excited for this.
And I'm especially pleased because Dietz and Watson does things the right way. So this means, like, no additives, no fillers, no artificial flavors, no cutting corners. You can feel good about this stuff.
Dietz and Watson. It's a family thing since 1939.
Shop now at dietzandwatson.com/the right way.
That's Dietz, D-I-E-T-Z, and watson.com/the right way.
I'm Molly.
And I'm Matthew.
And this is Spilled Milk, the show where we cook something delicious, eat it all, and you can't have any.
And today we're talking about congee.
That's right, and we have a special guest.
I'm excited. Yes. Congee, which is also called juk in Cantonese. It's also called okayu in Japanese and other things in other East Asian languages because it is a rice porridge dish that is popular throughout East Asia.
I am so excited to be talking about this. And I'm kind of stunned that it's taken us this long.
Yes. I mean, we do say that every time. But yeah.
That's true. It's true.
Oh, wait. I was going to say, should we begin on memory lane? But we have to remind people that our live show is next week.
It's a week from today. If you're listening on Thursday, May 6th, we got a live show a week from today. That's Thursday, May 13th at 6 p.m.
It's totally free. It's online. Go to bit.ly/spilledmilklive21 because you do need to register in order to attend the live show. And it is a lightning round episode, which means we need lots of topics. So send them to producer Abby by emailing topics@spilledmilkpodcast.com. One listener sent a topic directly to me and I was like, what?
Oh, no.
But I didn't even understand what was going on. And I think I made them feel bad. But I didn't mean to.
I accidentally did that to a student of mine a couple weeks ago who registered through like an outside organization.
Oh, okay.
Emailed me, I think, thinking that I would know who they were. Anyway, I'm sorry, student who I haven't yet met.
Yeah, we have a lot of apologizing to do. So let's get back to the episode.
Great. Okay. All right. So today we are talking about congee. And I'm here for it. I mean, evidently, I'm here in my closet for it.
That's right. So my congee memory lane, like the thing that I thought of, this is a dish that I haven't had very often. I want to talk about that with our guest, who, spoiler alert, is going to be cookbook author and magazine editor Hetty McKinnon. But I think it is a dish that that kind of exists in a context like, you know, within the cultures where it's enjoyed and like hasn't yet come along with other dishes from those cultures across the world as much as like stir-fried dishes
sure.
or, you know, braised dishes or fried dishes, because it is, you know, it's something that's often a breakfast dish. It's something you often eat like when you're not feeling well, and it's just kind of like soft and comforting. And so it's generally not billed as like, you know, this is going to be like a, you know, hit you in the mouth with flavor kind of dish. It
right.
serves a different function most of the time. So what I remember, my memory lane is a few years ago when I was spending a week in Hong Kong with teenager of the show, December, who was not yet a teenager. We'd been eating in Hong Kong for a few days. And like, I got to a point where I was like, kind of like homesick and like, you know,
cranky,
single parenting for a few days. And I was like, I want breakfast, and like, I'm sort of tired of going out to eat, and I just want something super like warm and comforting. And so we went to a place around the corner, and I had congee for breakfast that I think just had like some mushrooms and scallions and soy sauce that I drizzled on, and I burned my mouth on it. It's usually served super hot, but I remember it really well. I was like, oh, this was exactly what I needed.
And then did you stop being a cranky single parent? Did you meet meet someone that day and stop being single? Is that what happened?
Yes, that was, we had there was a kanji meet cute. There's like a little whirlwind romance. Gosh, I hope wife of the show, Lori, doesn't listen to this episode.
Okay. Well, Matthew, I dare say, I think I've eaten even less kanji than you have. Not by my own choice, you know. I would like to eat more.
Oh, someone's been preventing you from eating it?
No. The first time I remember having kanji was actually very recently. I think it was in 2016. I was in a town just outside of Toronto for a couple weeks. I was teaching writing there. And I had a weekend off, and I went into Toronto, and someone who I knew through Instagram but had never met, Emma Waverman. Shout out to Emma Waverman, who is a food writer. I think she's also on TV in Toronto. Anyway, she invited me to stay at her house. And her mother, Lucy Waverman, is like a very well-known food writer for a long time now in Toronto.
Oh, that's cool.
And anyway, so these two generations of Wavermans, Lucy and Emma, took me out for dim sum in Toronto. Oh my God. Well, for one thing, even though my dad's from Toronto, I've spent so little time there. And
I love Toronto. It's so great.
Yeah. Oh my God. Anyway, we went to this place that's sort of their usual dim sum spot. And I was happy to have them do all the ordering. I distinctly remember, I think the thing I remember most vividly from that morning was the kanji, which I, of course, spooned some chili oil into.
Oh, yeah.
And oh my God, it was just so good. It was also like November, so it was really cold outside. Oh my God, it was delicious.
Do you remember like what other flavorings it had?
You know, I don't. Okay. I don't. I really don't. I think that there was meat in it of some sort. I just remember I remember feeling so cared for, honestly.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, being away from home for 2 weeks in the winter. Yeah, it was delightful. Oh my God. I don't know why I didn't like come home and learn how to make it immediately.
Yeah, but it's not hard to make.
No, and we're going to talk more about that today.
Absolutely. So let's talk about the word a little bit, because I want to ask our guest about this for sure, because I feel like the word kanji, it has kind of a ring to it that I don't like, but I don't know if that's something that I'm bringing to it or if the word is like sort of falling out of favor.
Interesting. Okay.
Like it comes from Tamil via Portuguese, but like more often, like when I hear food writers. Yeah.
It comes from Tamil?
Yes. So the word itself has kind of a wild history. I didn't want to get like too into the etymology segment this week.
You mean you're not going to be Mr. Etymology?
Right, right.
Today?
Oh yes, the horse. Yes. I forgot it was a horse that teaches you word origins.
Anyway, no, I get it. I mean, I was very surprised to see here on the agenda that it's from Tamil, because I don't know. I just thought that it was going to be from Cantonese or, I don't know.
Right. No, that would totally make sense. The reason I'm not sure about like where the word stands now and like where it's going is because it's kind of an outsider word for this dish. It's not a native language word.
Okay.
You know, so in Cantonese and then also in Korean, it's called juk, which I'm probably getting the tone wrong because Chinese is tonal. It's also can be called zhou in Chinese.
Okay.
The Chinese character from it, I think I'm going to try and find a way to put this in the episode description. It has a really striking Chinese character that's sort of like the character for rice between the two of the character for bow and arrow.
Oh, wow. That's what it is?
Yeah, I mean, the bow and arrow part, I don't think has like a semantic meaning. It's just for to indicate how it's pronounced. But like, you know, you'll see a kanji shop and it'll have this character like a neon in the window. Mm-hmm. And my sense is that even if you don't read Chinese characters, this would be a character that would be very easy to learn to recognize.
Yes.
I just think it has a really cool look.
It's really striking.
Yeah, but people like in Hong Kong English, the word kanji still seems to be really, really common. As I mentioned, in Japanese, it's okayu, and it's It's a dish that I've had in Japan. Like, it's hard to say, like, in Japanese cooking, like, where the line is between okayu and rice dishes, where you kind of, like, stir some rice into, like, the dregs of a hot pot until the rice kind of dissolves, which is so good. So that's called zosui or ojia, depending on the texture.
Cool. So, you know, at its most basic, this dish is a rice porridge that's typically made from leftover rice.
Yes, it can definitely be made with uncooked rice and sometimes is, but leftover rice is most common, I think.
And it's typically flavored with salty or otherwise highly seasoned ingredients because, you know, rice itself, well, God, it lends itself to strong seasonings.
Yeah, and like it doesn't have to be seasoned that way. It's just like, you know, typically there'll be like some salted nuts or scallions or soy sauce or like little bits of seasoned meat or mushrooms.
And it's common throughout East Asia. I mean, I really think of it in Chinese cooking and in Korean cooking, but it's common throughout East Asia, right?
Yeah, no, like I learned, like, you know, a friend of the show, Pai Lin, has a Thai congee recipe that I sort of knew that it was eaten in Thailand, but haven't had the Thai version. But, like, you know, often it'll be flavored with fish sauce, of course.
Is there sort of like, so, you know, I'm thinking of it among other, like, food for ailing people, right? I'm thinking of, like, you know, like chicken noodle soup. Is there, like, a basic flavoring combo that, like, is sort of the base line, like, for congee?
I don't know the answer. Like, let's ask our guest. Like, I think it is usually made with stock, although it can be made with water. I keep saying over and over, like, you know, it can be made this way or it can be made this way. Like, it's a very basic preparation that can go, like, a wide variety of different directions, including, like, how much water to rice you use is, like, kind of the most fundamental decision about how you make congee.
Okay. I imagine it affects everything in terms of, like, texture and, I don't know, maybe it affects flavor too. I have no idea.
Yeah. Like, I feel like the most classic Cantonese version has, like, a little seasoned ground pork and some century egg or thousand-year-old egg.
Mm-hmm.
Have you had thousand-year-old eggs?
I haven't.
Oh, they're really good. They're what I wish a hard-boiled egg always tasted like.
Remind me of the preparation.
So they're, like, preserved in, like, an alkaline medium until the interior firms up and turns kind of black.
Uh-huh.
And so they're a dish that, you know, when you see it for the first time, you're like, oh, this is going to be very challenging if I didn't grow up with it. But actually, it's not at all. Mm-hmm. It's just they have an unusual look as far as eggs go. And but the flavor is very, you know, comforting and soft.
What is the flavor like? Does it get much flavor from the alkaline solution that it's in?
No,
or is it
really doesn't.
With...
It tastes like it doesn't have like a flavor that's really like separate from egg. It's really about, like, you know, eating an egg, but with a special, like, very smooth texture.
Okay. All right. I'm sold.
It's, you know what it's sort of like? It's sort of like a sous vide egg.
I was going to ask if it was that same kind of, like, whatever it is that happens when the proteins in the white very slowly solidify.
Yeah,
you know, making
it.
That, like, really silky texture.
So that's great with congee.
And I can imagine how good that would be in this, like, piping hot porridge. And I imagine that congee, like oatmeal, probably stays hot for an eternity.
Uh-huh. Yes. I made some the other day, and I'm like, okay, like, I know every time I've had this in the past, I burned my mouth on it, but now I'm, like, making it at home. I can let it sit. I'm not going to burn my mouth. And I let it sit as long as I could stand before digging in, and I've still burned my mouth. It was super hot. I think I once read a Harold McGee article or like chapter from a book about, like, why some things take so long to cool down. And it has to do with, like, you know, the flow of heat within the medium getting interrupted by, like, chunky things.
That was such a great explanation, Matthew.
I'm just reading from his chapter.
It really, you know, cleared it right up for me.
That's verbatim from Harold McGee, like, the great explainer of food science. Said, you know, I don't know, there's, like, some chunky shit in there or something. Why are you asking me this?
Okay. All right. Let's wait for Hetty.
We are joined by Hetty McKinnon, who is the author of Community, the editor of Peddler, co-host of the House Specials podcast, and also author of the new book, To Asia with Love. That's why we wanted to have her on to talk about congee this week. Hedy McKinnon, welcome to Spilled Milk.
Thank you. What a pleasure to be here. And I'm so excited to talk about congee.
I have one thing I want to say about To Asia with Love. Hedy, I love that that it's all film photography in that book, right?
Yes, it's 100% film.
Oh my gosh, it's so beautiful. And I loved what you wrote about choosing to do film photography and your dad's connection to film photography. And anyway, I just wanted to say, I think it creates such a special feel to the book that is so perfect for the whole vibe of what the book is doing. And I just hope everybody will go out and pick up a copy.
Absolutely. I did not know that about film photography, but I noticed the photos were beautiful.
Yes. Thank you. Yeah. I really did want to create something that was like fully respectful of where I'm from and my culture. And I've done some food photography for Peddler, the magazine, but in a commercial book, I thought no way a publisher's going to agree to this. But we have this great relationship and they just said, go for it, or we trust you to do it. So it felt like an experiment, and I did back up everything with digital, but I ended up only using film.
It really, I mean, as though, you know, your voice and the subject matter didn't already set it apart. I feel like the photography just makes it so warm. I just had to say, I really love that.
Thank you.
The thing I noticed about the book, and I hope this is a nice thing to say about a vegetarian cookbook, I got about halfway through the book and like maybe more and suddenly realized, wait a minute, is this a vegetarian cookbook? Like, I didn't even notice that. Like, just like everything was just incredibly appealing. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to cook this one. I'm going to cook this one. I'm going to cook this one.
Absolutely. And I've always tried to do my books like that. Like, even since the beginning, like with Community, I'd always ask my publishers, please don't put this in the vegetarian category.
Right.
I don't want it on the vegetarian shelf, because my food is about inclusiveness. Like, that is kind of the foundations of all my work in food, is connecting people, bringing people together. The fact that it doesn't have meat is kind of just a moot point.
Because
I'm really trying to show people what they're getting out of this food rather than what they're losing. And I feel like sometimes the vegetarian tag just tells people you're actually going to miss out on something
exactly.
from the very beginning.
God, that's very true. Well, I think it's perfect then that we're talking about congee. Well, for one thing, we're really happy to be talking with you about congee, because Matthew and I, this is something that we both really want to learn more about. Mm-hmm. And also, it's something that, you know, I think when both of us have eaten congee, it's been with meat. So I'm really curious to learn more about it sort of outside of that context.
Yeah. Okay. So this is a dish. I mean, it's so fun because growing up, it was really one of the staple dishes that we ate. Like, my mom would be, I have really vivid memories of her, like when I was a little bit older, we'd be sitting on the couch and, you know, in the mornings we'd finish our breakfast or whatever. And she'd just look over to me and go, I want congee. I want juk today. So she would like rush into the kitchen and start getting everything together. So it's just such a, it's just a staple in our house. So it's kind of strange to me that it's now quite a trendy meal. Like,
sure.
People love to talk about congee and all the ways of eating it. And to us, I could never have imagined as a 16-year-old that, you know, many decades later, I would be writing a juk recipe, and a juk recipe that's very different to the way my mother cooked it. And then it would be such a trendy recipe that, and it's been adapted like a million times. Like, that's kind of wild to me to think about that. But I'll tell you a funny story, because a lot of people talk about congee in the context that, oh, it's the dish my mum made when I was sick, or it's what I wanted to eat to feel better when I couldn't digest anything. Mm-hmm. But in our family, it was really different. It was not a meal that was served when you were ill or sick. It was just something to satisfy a craving, really. And so to me, I don't have those memories of it as, mm-hmm. as something I ate only when I was feeling poorly. It was a meal that, this is always a very strange story I tell about this dish. My mum made juk when it was really hot.
Okay.
Right. So my mom's like this really kind of typical, you know, Asian Chinese mother who believes in like a lot of Eastern medicine and a lot about, you know, the yin and the yang and balancing temperatures in the body. And so her belief, her very strong belief, is that when it was really hot, the way to cool yourself down is to have a really hot meal or dish, because that way your body can kind of sweat out all the heat that's in your body. So we ate a lot of congee when it was really hot on hot summer days.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because Molly and I were talking about how, like, one of the things we think of when we think about our memories of eating congee is that it is one of the hottest dishes, not in terms of chili, but in terms of temperature.
It takes so long to cool down.
Like, you have to, like, blow on it and wait, and you're going to burn your mouth anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, on a hot summer day, summer's coming up, you know, just make some congee.
So you live in New York, right?
I live in New York now, yes.
Do you still make congee when it's hot outside?
I kind of do, yeah.
Yeah? I love it.
And it's kind of one of those things that, you know, like they say, you know, you turn into your mother and you never want to admit that at some point in your life. And then at some point you just kind of give into it and go, I have turned into my mother. I do believe all these weird things that she would say. And they're not weird. They are grounded in you know, rituals and ancient traditions. But as a kid growing up in Australia, like, I just wanted to be Australian. So everything she did was kind of weird to me. But, you know, her congee was meat. I mean, I ate meat until I was about 19. And before that, I had tried almost every meat under the sun. You know, we grew up with, you know, a balanced diet, but, you know, always like with meat in things balanced with vegetables. But when I decided to go vegetarian, she started making different versions of things that she cooked throughout her life. So the juk was one thing. There's many different versions of congee too. There's not just one. The staple one that we would eat maybe like at breakfast time or during the day, it's not something we eat at dinner. So it's more like a daytime dish. You know, that would be very flavorsome. And we didn't top it with a lot of things like I've done in this book. It would just be like cilantro and Maggi seasoning. That was kind of the staple. Mm-hmm. But there were other versions of congee. Like, so during celebrations, like Chinese New Year or birthdays, when we ate a lot of savory food, she would make what she would call bak juk, which is a white congee, and it would be completely flavorless. So bland.
Oh, wow.
And no salt. I would still put Maggi in it, but she would kind of get mad at us because it's like, that is meant to be the antidote to all the big savory flavors that you're eating. So it's almost like a palate cleanser.
So would she'd cook it in water as opposed to stock?
Yeah, just water. Yeah.
Wow.
So it would be sort of serving the same function as steamed rice?
Kind of,
in the meal?
Yeah. Yes. And like typically those meals wouldn't be rice involved in those meals. So we would have that. She would always make rice, but like not all of us would eat it because it would be typically a noodle, you know, kind of a noodle feast on the table, dumplings, some other kind of steamed glutinous savory type dumplings. And then there would be the white congee as kind of a balance to all of that. So there are very many different versions of it. And I have to say, I've never really developed a really traditional congee recipe.
How do you make yours today?
So today I do two versions. One is really untraditional. It's made with brown rice and some quinoa. And I laugh because it's kind of like, I feel like it's silly in context of like how the congee I grew up eating. But that's one version. It's brown rice. It kind of cooks in the same amount of time. Like, people have this perception of brown rice taking a really long time to cook, but it really doesn't.
Well, yeah. I've always wondered when I see that written in cookbooks, I always feel like it's a vestige of like 1970s vegetarianism. Yes. I've never had brown rice take that long to cook or anything that felt notable. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah, and I also, one thing that I often do is I cook white and brown rice together. Mm-hmm. And once I put it on Instagram and people went crazy. They were like, this is not possible. You know, they take two different times to cook. Do you pre-soak your brown rice? And I was like, I don't do anything different. I just put them literally in the pot together. What, you know, rinse the rice and I cook it exactly the same, same amount of water, and somehow it works. I can't explain the science behind it, but it works. Anyway, back to the brown rice congee. Yeah. So that one, I will do brown rice, some quinoa, and I put lots of ginger, dried shiitake mushrooms. And my mum always used black-eyed peas in her.
I noticed that in the book. I wanted to ask you about that.
Yeah, she always put that in. And it was one of those ingredients that she had this kind of pantry, and it had all her medicinal Chinese ingredients, because we had like a medicinal like tong soup every night before dinner. And then I always remembered very vividly this kind of jar of black-eyed peas. And she would put that in her congee to add a kind of sweetness to it. Mm-hmm. So now it's something I really want in any congee I make, is I want that black-eyed peas. It's a really kind of memorable aroma to me. Like when I cook black-eyed peas, it really does remind me of my mum's kitchen. So I put that in there, and then, you know, not much else. I mean, sometimes I will use stock. Sometimes I'll just use water. Certain Asian cultures cook more with stock in their congee, like a broth, like a flavored broth. Often I'll just use water. And so that's one version. And then the one in the book is actually a leftover rice congee, because congee does take 2 hours to cook, like a good amount of time.
Is that whether you use raw rice or leftover rice? Is it about the same?
No. So raw rice is traditionally what's used, a very small amount of raw rice to a lot of liquid.
Yeah.
And it will take about 2 hours to really break down.
Okay.
And it's also different consistencies. Some people like their congee really thick, almost like a bowl of rice that's just got a little bit of liquid in it. We traditionally ate one that was more kind of liquidy, so it would be cooked for a good 2 hours. But the one in the book is made with leftover rice and more rice. 2 cups of rice, of leftover rice, any rice that you've got in the fridge, and it cooks in about half an hour. So for me, it's just a little bit more friendly to, you know, a modern life where you're just got a lot on, and it's also one of those ways to use up leftover rice, you know?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. No, I'm glad you mentioned that, like it's a long cooked dish, because what it reminded me of is polenta.
Yes.
And how, like, you know, polenta, both polenta and congee go through a phase where, like, you could eat it at this point, but it hasn't reached its potential yet.
Yes.
It's sort of like an overcooked grain dish that then is going to, like, magically transform in, like, another 30 or 60 minutes of cooking into something perfect that's its own thing.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, I think patience is one of those things we don't have a lot of in the kitchen nowadays, you know, because everything is, like, 30 minutes, 5 ingredients,
right.
30 minutes. And I kind of love, I mean, even though I did do a leftover rice one in the book, because I was, like, you know, trying to show people all the different versions, I think that there is, like, real joy in really putting time in something, and it's a really uncomplicated dish.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to kind of trust time and your stove and let it do its thing. So that's like the joy in a dish like this, and also like lots of slow cooking too, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely.
I love the look of your everyday oil recipe in the book. And I feel like that is exactly the kind of thing that I want on congee. Is that sort of the oil that you, or the condiment, what condiment do you tend to reach for with congee?
I do put that on congee. And when I developed the everything, what I now call everything oil, but in the, you know, years ago when I first developed that recipe, it was just the chili oil to me.
Mm-hmm.
So it's based on, it's rooted in like a Sichuan chili oil with a lot of spices in there. So there's like cinnamon, there's star anise, which is a really evocative smell for me because it's just something my mum used a lot in all her cooking. And there's like a lot of aromatics. So it's just full of spice, but then there's a lot of aroma in there too. That's other things. So I did really develop this recipe to eat with congee, even though I didn't eat it growing up with congee. We just ate it very plain. But now with some of the toppings that I've got, particularly in the book, they're kind of more modern approach to congee. Things that like kind of congee, but like you know, made for my lifestyle.
Yes, I noticed there's one with kale chips as a topping.
Exactly. Oh, that's
which sounds really good.
It's wildly fantastic because you've got this kind of mellow, it's a mellow base congee, and then you've got this kind of the texture of that crunchy kale, and then the chili oil on top of that, and it's just perfection. It's so good and comforting. But then I've got another one that's got, you know, mushrooms that have been pan fried with five mm-hmm. spice powder and tahini. And that is certainly not traditional. There's a lot of tahini in this book, but it doesn't deviate that far from tradition because there's, you know, we eat a lot of Chinese sesame paste, which is it's a slightly different flavor. It's more intense. Yeah. It's made from roasted sesame seeds. But it's hard to get, and I'm going to completely just say it's really hard to get. Even in my neighborhood, if I try and go out and find it, I can't find it, so I have to go to a specialty store. So with this book, I tried to really democratize some of the ingredients and just go, well, tahini is going to give you a pretty good result, not completely authentic or traditional, but you're going to get that flavor. So congee with tahini is quite good.
It sounds good. I want to ask about what word we should be using to talk about this dish, because when I was researching, like, I learned mm-hmm. that kanji is sort of an outsider word for it, and you call it juk in the book.
Yes.
Do you think that people, when talking about this dish, should use a more localized term? Does kanji feel okay to you? What do you think?
So kanji, I feel like, is an overarching word for okay. all the different, I don't know if this is true, by the way, this is just how I perceive it.
Yeah.
So I feel like there's many different versions of this dish across Asian countries. I know that India has a version. I actually have a t-shirt. I should have worn it, actually. I have a t-shirt with all the different congees from all the different Asian countries. And I can't believe I didn't wear it today. But in India, it's called kanji, like K-A-N-J-I, I believe. Mm-hmm. That could be the wrong spelling. In Korean, it's also called juk, but they often spell it J-U-K. Mm-hmm. I've always just used juk, like J-O-O-K. That's how we say it in Cantonese. So there's many different iterations of it across Asia. So I'm just wondering whether congee is used because it just is like this kind of overarching...
An umbrella term, sort
umbrella
of.
Umbrella term for all the different versions. I don't know if I'm the right person to ask whether that's correct or not. It's funny because in the Australian version of this book, it's called congee, but in the US version, I asked it to be changed to juk because I feel like different countries are more advanced in the way certain foods are represented. Okay. And I really did feel like in America, when you say juk, people really know what you're talking about.
I think that's true. That's true in New York. I don't think it's true in every part of America.
Well, let's try and get it that way.
But yeah, absolutely.
Step in the right direction.
Yeah. What do you guys think, though, about the whole congee versus juk versus kanji?
I don't know. I feel like it's something I'm just starting to learn about. Like, as far as I can tell, like linguists seem to agree that the word originated in Tamil and made it to East Asia via the Portuguese.
Oh, yes.
And so it's sort of like a mix of, like, you know, this is a word that is used in South Asia, but is not a word that's native to East Asia languages. And, like, so it feels like sort of a, like, middle ground. Like, I was not totally sure going to this episode, like, is this kind of an okay thing to call this dish, or is it, like, a very sort of, like, outsidery term? But it sounds like it's kind of okay.
Yeah, I'm not always like that up with what's the correct. I just kind of, like, go with what I know. And mm-hmm.
Yeah, of course.
People have asked me this before, but I never know what the right answer is.
Hedy, do you have any tips for improvising flavor combinations for juk? Do you, like, for instance, you know, kale chips would be crunchy. Mm-hmm. Are you looking for different textures as well as flavors?
I think it's a real personal journey, juk. I mean, I do think traditionally it's herbs on the top with, you know, some sort of, not even always soy sauce, but, you know, I really love maggi on it. I'm obsessed with maggi. And it's something that I kind of was ashamed of for a lot of my life, because there are these ingredients where you just go, I don't think that's acceptable to put maggi on things. And then I got to the point where I was like, I'm not going to be ashamed of these things that I loved growing up. You know, like bouillon cubes that my mom, like a lot of immigrant cooks cook with really basic ingredients that are really flavorsome. And, you know, like bone broth, she just made bone broth without thinking this was an indulgent thing.
Right.
But she also used bouillon cubes and chicken bouillon cubes and, you know, lots of Maggi products. And I don't know, I kind of feel like a part of my journey in life, like being a daughter of Chinese immigrants and growing up in a Western world, kind of felt like I tried to mute a lot of those aspects of my life, and I didn't really want to tell people the things that I was really eating at home. Like, and now I'm just like, Maggi is like, it's such an amazing product that is used in a lot of countries. I think it actually originated in Switzerland.
I was going to say, I first heard about it in Germany.
Yes.
That was the first time I ever encountered it.
Yeah. And there's lots of different variations of it across the world, depending on, you know, the tastes of wherever that they're from. And some are more garlicky, some are more spicy. But anyway, Maggi, I really associated with congee a lot. Mm. But in terms of like changing, like for me, I really try to tailor it to my taste, hence the things like kale chips on the top. Mm-hmm. Hence the, I also have a recipe in there for a carrot salad that goes on the top. So it's, it's not true. People are probably, if you hear about this kind of not in the context of reading the rest of the book, I'm sure people will say, oh my God, what is she doing? Like she's like crazy and just bastardizing this whole dish. But that one is one I eat a lot because I love the textural element of it, like the freshness on the top, which is just going a little bit further than the herbs, which is more traditional, right? But the textural element is really lovely. But I think you could almost do kind of anything. I really like like some sort of crunch and freshness for the top.
Yeah.
I'm quite a rogue cook sometimes, and you know, I think you could add anything really. Like sometimes I have done, like I've dropped an egg into it as it's ready, and like cook the egg through it. My mom has savory oats for breakfast every morning because that is her like really super quick way of getting a meal that's kind of like congee, but she hasn't had the time to make it. And she's like in her 70s and kind of on her own now. So she'll have savory oats for breakfast almost every morning, and she breaks an egg through it for extra protein. So I tend to do that sometimes too. There's a lot of rule breaking in my cooking, but I think so much of like the narrative in food is about authenticity. But what we forget is the people who actually, you know, like I'm getting all my authenticity from my mom, but she breaks the same rules. She's also doing things that have evolved the recipes that she cooked for us growing up. So I kind of get my license to do it from her.
I love that.
I've definitely had an egg stirred through in Japan, like in a zosui dish, which is not exactly the same as congee because the rice isn't quite as fall apart, but very similar. And like usually an egg will be stirred through and very good.
Oh, that sounds fantastic. You know, I wanted to tell you about this one other type of congee that was my children's first food. It's a steamed congee. My mom calls it jukjae, which kind of translates to like little congee, like little jukjae. And so it's one that's steamed. So she will have like chicken, like so she'll flavor the chicken and then she'll just put it through the raw rice. And then there's a little container, which I have here with me. It's like a little clay pot and it's steamed for, I don't know how long. I tried to make it recently just with shiitake mushrooms because I had a craving for it. And so the rice breaks down, but it's not like, it's not soupy in consistency.
Okay.
It's like a steamed rice, but slightly almost like pudding-like. So
interesting. I've never had this.
It's really cool. And she only ever made it for when my kids were little. And I definitely remember eating it when I was young.
Have you written up the recipe anywhere?
I've never done it. Never done it. Maybe in the future. But I tried to get the consistency of it right just a few weeks ago when I had a craving for it and it wasn't perfect. I need to ask her again the exact, because I used to make it when my kids were young. But that's a really kind of fun, different version of what we do call congee, but it's not what anyone would recognize as congee.
Excellent. Well, Hetty McKinnon, thank you so much for being on Spilled Milk and teaching us so much. This was really fun.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, guys.
This episode is brought to you by Masterclass.
Matthew, take a minute and picture that thing that you've always wanted to learn.
All right, I'm picturing the thing.
Okay.
And you know, what if I get lost in the wilderness?
Well, okay, this is the thing?
This is the thing.
Oh, okay. Well, so picture learning it from someone who's literally the best at getting lost in the wilderness.
No, no, no.
In the world.
You no? don't understand, Molly. I want to get found in the wilderness.
Oh,
so,
okay.
And for that, I turn to Jesse Krebs, who is an internationally recognized expert on wilderness survival. She has a class on Masterclass, and she teaches like the five basic needs. And if you think number one is water, you're wrong. She teaches you how to use a knife, how to use rope, one of your most important tools in the wilderness. I don't think I'm going to get stuck in the wilderness, but if I do, I'm going to be really happy that I took this class on Masterclass.
Yeah, well, Masterclass is where you should go if you don't just want to think about learning something, but you actually want to do it with one-on-one classes with the world's best.
Yeah, if you want to learn singing from Christina Aguilera, if you want to learn shooting threes from Steph Curry, there's only one place in the world to do those things, unless you happen to know those people, which you don't.
Yeah, you don't. And every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's no risk.
And right now, our listeners will get an additional 15% off an annual membership at masterclass.com/spilledmilk15.
That's 15% off right now at masterclass.com/spilledmilk15.
masterclass.com/spilledmilk15.
Emmy Award-winning John Mulaney presents Everybody's in L.A., a special run of 6 live episodes created by and starring Mulaney that'll stream live on Netflix during the Netflix is a Joke Fest. The comically unconventional show will feature special guests where John Mulaney explores the city of Los Angeles during a week when every funny person is in it. Watch John Mulaney Presents Everybody's in L.A., debuting May 3rd live at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, only on Netflix.
Wow, I feel like I learned a lot.
Oh, she was fantastic. I would like to listen to her talk about every dish in her book at that length.
Yeah, well, I mean, she has her own podcast, which we'll link to in the show notes. So
yes, the house specials.
Yes. All right, do we have anything else about kanji or juk or okayu to talk about?
I don't think I do. I mean, except that now I'm like...
I want to experiment more. Like this is yes. This is something that I'm going to like make in like variations over the next few weeks. And I don't care if it's hot out.
I'm really curious to try her. I think I'm going to try her recipe for leftover rice, juk. And then I think I will try like a full on, you know, cooking from the raw rice.
Yeah,
starting point. And see, I'm curious about how different they might be, or maybe not. Anyway, I'm excited.
Yeah, I think I didn't realize, like, you know, the New York food world really, like, is months or years ahead of us. And, like, yes. I don't think I had any sense that this was, like, a trendy food in the U.S. Like, I knew that there was, briefly, a congee restaurant that started as a pop-up in Seattle, Kraken Congee.
Oh, my God, yes. Yeah,
I think it closed. I don't know if it closed like during COVID or just before, but
I remember it was in Pioneer Square,
right.
And there was often a line outside at lunchtime. Huh, I didn't realize it was gone. Bummer.
Okay, so possibly this is something all of our listeners, whether they're of East Asian descent or not, have been cooking all along, and they should be telling us about it.
Yeah. Pretty much. In this case, maybe they're not letting us have any, like, you know, the reverse.
Exactly.
Of,
it's about time we get a taste. We don't get a taste of our own medicine.
Okay. All right, Matthew, let's move into the old segments.
All right. Okay. I got some last minute spilled mail that I wanted to share. From listener Rochelle. Listening to episode 143, Jarred Spaghetti Sauce. You guys discussed how scary jarred Alfredo sauce is, and I fully agree. It freaks me out. So that being said, could you guys do an episode on it?
Wait, on jarred Alfredo sauce?
Yes.
Oh, I can't believe she's done this to us. This is like,
I mean, it's almost my fault for reading the letter, but
God, she's thrown down. We've been served.
Yeah, we've been served a jar of sauce, and now
we have to eat it.
I think we have to do it.
Oh, God. Because,
like, I don't know if I've ever had jarred Alfredo sauce. It seems like inherently a bad idea, but what if it's good?
If I've had it, it would have been in, like, an institutional setting, like my high school cafeteria or my college cafeteria, that kind of thing.
An Olive Garden. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, okay, listener Rochelle.
All right, we'll do it. This doesn't mean that anybody can write in with any idea and we'll do it. But do get in touch with ideas.
Don't abuse the privilege.
Exactly.
Matthew, what was the name of my quilting segment?
Oh, it was Calling It Quilts. Is it back?
So I'm not making a quilt right now. However,
end of segment.
Hold on. I did just finish my largest knitting project ever, which was kind of a knitted quilt. I made a log cabin pattern is like a classic, you know, historical quilt pattern. Can you picture it in a log cabin?
No. I'm going to Google it.
Okay. Well, anyway, the yarn.
Oh, I can now.
See, the yarn company Pearl Soho, which also, you know, puts a bunch of patterns out into the world. Pearl Soho released a pattern for like a log cabin quilt. So basically you make the log cabin pattern using panels of knitting.
Okay.
Anyway, I tried it. Not using Pearl Soho's yarn because that was expensive. But anyway, okay. I just kind of winged it using approximately their pattern and made a like throw blanket. It took me about 2 months. And that was like, I pretty much only worked on it when we were watching a show on Netflix or whatever.
Okay.
And it's the biggest and most successful knitting project I've done to date.
How big is it? Is it like a football field size?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
No, like a throw blanket.
Okay.
You know how I've said I really hate following patterns? Well, I didn't measure it. I really kind of winged it with the pattern. So I really don't know how big this thing is. But
okay. And there's no way to find out.
It's definitely not just sitting folded up on my sofa right now. Nope.
Okay.
Anyway,
that's
so
great.
There you go. I'm calling it quilts.
What are there any other segments that are going to rise from the dead? Animal Crossing? Been playing any Animal Crossing?
Nope, not lately. Nope.
I have a new segment. It's called What Am I Sitting On?
Oh, did you get a cozy life?
Comfy Life.
Oh, Comfy Life. Right. Comfy
yes.
Life. How
oh,
is
that
it?
The same one you got?
Yes, I have a Comfy Life.
Yes, I knew you had gotten like the horseshoe shaped
butt pad.
Seat cushion, butt pad. And I figured probably the one I ordered was the same one you got since it seemed to be the most popular one. But yeah, I'm living that comfy life.
How is it?
It's wonder. I'm sitting on it right now and I've never been happier.
I feel like it raises me up just the right amount for using my computer at my dining table.
Yeah.
And it also kind of positions my back better.
Yeah, I'm loving it.
This is not sponsored content.
It's not sponsored content. I put like the little cutout in front at first, and then I read the instructions and learned that that's supposed to go in back. And it was much more comfortable after I started using it the right way.
Oh my God, I'm using it the wrong way, Matthew. I've been using it the wrong way all this time. Wait a minute. The horseshoe opens behind me?
The horseshoe opens behind you. So that's like a little cutout for your tailbone, sort of.
What? Oh, my God.
I know. It doesn't seem like it should be that way.
This is amazing. Okay. All right. I'm gonna switch it around.
Yeah. I mean, of course, it's your butt pad. You can use it any way you want. Like,
okay.
no one from the Comfy Life Corporation is going to come and inspect.
Okay. Hey, do you have a cute animal I should know about?
I do. This was suggested by Burke Beck Cat on Reddit, and it's Fiona the baby hippo. And Fiona the baby hippo lives at the Cincinnati Zoo.
Oh my God, here she comes. She's celebrating her fourth birthday, everybody, and she is about to eat a cake that appears to be made of gelatin and fruit.
Yeah.
With what looks like eucalyptus leaves around it.
There's a lot of videos of Fiona the baby hippo, but I chose this one because, like, who doesn't want to be invited to a hippo's birthday?
Oh my God, I love her. Her skin is really beautiful. I bet she uses serums.
So shiny. And there's gonna be a guest star coming on in a minute.
Really? Oh God, she is. It looks like she's kind of gnawing on the pedestal that this cake is on.
Yeah, I mean, like my cat will gnaw on like a cardboard box, a chair leg.
Here comes another one. Who's this? Do you know who this is?
No, but it's like a bigger hippo, so maybe it's like a parental hippo unit.
Oh my God, I love her big old lips, which seem kind of like stiff.
Yeah.
You know?
I like Fiona because it seems like Fiona could literally crush you with love.
Literally. I mean, aren't hippos like kind of vicious?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're very like protective. They, you know, they act in self-defense, I think.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, as a hippo public defender, that's my take.
Hold on. I'm looking at the comments for Fiona's fourth birthday YouTube. Oh, here's Leaf396 who says, I remember when she learned how to swim.
Oh, we should find that video. Okay, next week, Fiona the baby hippo learns how to swim.
Oh, this is delightful. Oh, okay. All right. Thanks, everybody.
Right.
Thanks, Matthew. Okay, now but wow, stuff we're into this week. All right, Matthew, I can't remember. Have you read the book, the novel Pachinko?
I haven't.
Okay.
Many, many people close to me have read it.
Great. It is by Min Jin Lee, and I have read it. And anyway, she has an article that came out in the New York Times about a month ago, in early April. It's an essay. The title is A Lifetime of Reading Taught Min Jin Lee How to Write About Her Immigrant World. And I was drawn to read this not only because I loved Pachinko, but I also just, I love reading people writing about the books that have influenced them, specifically writers writing about the books that have influenced them.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, so this is a really wonderful and quite moving article, in large part about her Uncle John and like the way in which going to the library basically kind of pulled her whole family up.
Okay.
It was her Uncle John who sponsored her family, Min Jin Lee's family, to immigrate from South Korea. And anyway, the whole essay is kind of a love note to education and to reading, really, and to the like.
Okay. I mean, I'm against those things, but maybe this will change my mind.
Yeah. Anyway, it's really great. Go check it out.
All right. We'll link to it in the show notes.
I just put her first book on hold at the library, so I'm excited to read more of her.
All right.
Check it out.
My Now But Wow is one of those NPR Tiny Desk concerts.
Oh, yeah.
This is a tiny desk at home, of course. And it is with the band Steady Holiday, which is the product of a singer-songwriter named Dre Babinski, which is one of the best names you can say, I think.
Fantastic name.
And this is one of the best musical performances I've watched in a long time.
Cool.
I had not been familiar with her. I think YouTube maybe just recommended, like, you know, you seem to like indie rock, you'll like this. The songwriting is fantastic. The performance is funny. She keeps adding, like, you know, little fun twists to the performance and allows herself to, like, laugh, you know, at her own jokes while singing the songs, which, I mean, I would never laugh at my own jokes, but it's nice when other people do it.
Yeah, you never laugh at your own jokes.
I am now, like, obsessed with this record. She has a record called Take the Corners Gently. Every song on it is a fucking banger. I just love songwriting more than anything else in the world, and she is so good at it. So check out Steady Holiday, Tiny Desk, and her new album, Take the Corners Gently.
Oh, this is awesome. Okay. Well, you can find us where you already found us.
Our producer is Abby Circatella, who really has her work cut out for her this week.
Sorry, Abby. And you can, I don't know, jump on the old Spilled Milk Reddit and talk to us and to other people.
It's reddit.com/r/everythingspilledmilk. You can also jump on a Comfy Life brand butt pad. I recommend that.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Thank you for listening to Spilled Milk, the show that doesn't burn your mouth, but it does burn your ears. I'm Molly Weisenberg.
And I'm Matthew Amster Burton.
I'm Molly.
Well, I mean, we have cameras on. You could see that I was taking a drink of water.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.